From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Congratulations to college football champs Georgia, defeating Alabama 33-18. Great game. If you're listening to us tonight on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles at 11 p.m. Pacific time, switch on over to the iHeartRadio app. They're doing some tower upgrades, so you won't be able to get us on the radio station. That should be done pretty soon, by the way. Later tonight, consciousness, and here's what's happening. Well, today started the work week with 15 million people under wind chill alerts stretching from the northern plains and upper Midwest into the interior northeast and New England. Wind chills across the upper Midwest were forecast to be as cold as, get this, 45 degrees below zero, and wind chills across the northeast and New England as cold as 35 degrees below zero. Brr, winter is here. The death toll from Sunday's horrific Bronx, New York fire has been revised. The city officials now reporting that 17 people died in that massive blaze. The New York Police Department previously thought 19 people had died. Most of them were children, eight of them. Very sad. Bob Saget has died at the age of 65. Multiple sources connected to the iconic comedian and actor, most famous for his starring role as Danny Tanner in Full House, tell us he passed away Sunday at the Ritz-Carlton in Orlando, Florida. No cause of death yet. They are ruling out, of course, any foul play or some kind of prescription overdose or anything like that at this time. The cause of actress Betty White's death on New Year's Eve at the age of 99 was apparently a stroke that she had suffered nearly a week earlier, according to a copy of the death certificate posted online. The chip shortage is likely to persist through 2022, despite wishful thinking that it could ease by mid-year, according to a semiconductor company executive. Synaptics say that all signs point to the chip shortage continuing. The semiconductor industry is dealing with limited foundry capacity, and chip demand remains red hot. Let's check in with our expert, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, what's causing the chip shortage?
Well, ultimately, the problem is that the whole world relies on really one country, and in fact one company in one country, for the majority of sophisticated chips, and that's a company in Taiwan. And they got that way because most of the rest of the world, and especially the U.S., just willingly said, okay, fine, if you want to make them, we're not going to bother.
Right.
And so it wasn't like they forced it. Taiwan didn't force us to do this. Companies just made business decisions independently. And also, the other part of this is, of course, Taiwan's government, like most governments around the world except for us, are very willing to have the government fund important industries to give them a leg up. We don't like to do that here very much, but it means those other countries have an advantage. Now, that's the supply side of this. And in fact, I should mention, I'm hearing now that even fairly unsophisticated commodity-type chips are now getting to be in short supply also, not just the really fancy ones. Now, the demand side of this, obviously, smartphones, you know, they use a lot of chips. We hear a lot about cars, and
sure
cars
do.
Are a driving force. The average modern car can have hundreds of sophisticated chips in it. It can be running upwards of 100 million lines of code. There are some observers who think that there's tech bloat in the cars, that really there's features now that only a fraction of buyers really want. But as long as the car manufacturers are trying to judge each other, you know, they're each trying to get one up by adding this feature, that feature, this feature, they need more and more of these chips. And what has happened now is it's gotten so bad that there are cars shipping without the features they were supposed to have. So,
oh, my gosh.
There were cars that were supposed to have touchscreens. They don't have touchscreens right now because the chips to drive the touchscreens just aren't available. And now we're starting to see some pretty ironic kind of secondary effects. It was just announced within the last couple of days. We know how some printer manufacturers, computer printer manufacturers, try to lock people into their cartridges so you can't use other cartridges in their printers. You have to buy them from the manufacturer of the printer. And that's usually done with chips that are included in cartridges. Well, Canon has run into a chip shortage, and it turns out that on a German site at least, they are giving users of their printers the instructions for bypassing the low toner error codes that would normally appear, because they're appearing now because there's no chip. So it looks like it's a counterfeit cartridge. So ironically, the chip shortage is actually causing these consumer products to start behaving in strange ways. It's not just sophisticated cars, not just hybrids, not just plug-in electrics. It's things as relatively mundane now as printers. And as you said, there are no signs that this is going to let up. Even if people wanted to throw billions and billions of dollars at the problem, building chip fabs, the chip foundries, is very time-consuming. It is very expensive. Getting them running takes years. Built and running takes years. So, yeah, it looks like right now everything points to this shortage continuing through 2022, and we can only hope that 23 will be better.
What a mess. Thanks, Lauren. High levels of T-cells from common cold coronaviruses can provide protections against COVID-19, according to the Imperial College in London, according to their study, which could inform approaches for second-generation vaccines. Immunity against COVID-19 is a very complex picture, and while there's evidence of a waning antibody level 6 months after vaccination, T-cells are also believed to play a vital role in providing some protection. Mediating for a few minutes and just taking it easy are the first steps in helping the body fight off cancer and viruses like COVID-19, according to a new study. A team from the University of Florida found that meditation and yoga programs, or inner engineering practices, dramatically boost the body's immune system. How about that? Could joining a soccer team or taking a daily jog be the key to good grades for children? There's a correlation between a child's cardiorespiratory health and their academic success, particularly in language and math, according to another study. Such intellectual qualities, including memory and concentration, may be improved by cardio exercises. Their parents take heed. What's going on in the skies these days? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George. We begin proudly with space and our weekly James Webb Telescope update. The saga of this James Webb Telescope, George, continues as we now can report positively that it is now fully deployed in space, though not operational yet, with some amazing science to come. And the telescope is now, get a load of this, some 717,000 miles from the Earth. That's some 80% of its near million-mile L2 position that it should attain in a couple of weeks. But more interesting, on the spacecraft itself, temperatures on the sunward side are now 130 degrees Fahrenheit, and on the important dark side, where the mirror and electronics is, minus 329 degrees below zero on the Fahrenheit scale. But it's amazing. That's only a 6-foot separation between those temperatures from the sun shields. That's great science. And we're talking about this as the particular object. We're talking about the James Webb Telescope. It's going to be moving on, that is, to a position where they're going to have to realign the mirrors and get this particular spacecraft ready for some serious science. Continuing, George, with space, we talk about the U-2-2. That's a Chinese spacecraft that's now revealed the nature of this mystery hut that it observed on the moon. What was it? Well, the Chinese lunar rover on the far side of the moon, known as U-2-2, or in Chinese, Jade Rabbit, spotted a large hut-like structure on the horizon a few weeks ago. This amazing little machine, the rover is some 4 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, and has solar power and a radioisotope power source to move it around in the dark of the moon, of course, when you can't see sunlight. And this particular rover has now set a record as the longest working rover on the surface of the moon, traveling some 1,000 meters so far. But the rover actually found that the hut-like structure, George, is nothing but a large rock. And get a load of this, in the shape of a rabbit. The rover is exploring the far southern lunar crater known as Von Karman. So the space scientists have named that boulder Jade Rabbit just because it looks like a rabbit. In astronomy, a red giant star is captured going supernova. What's that? In a science first, astronomers have watched a giant star blow up and collapse as a supernova. That is a red giant star known as SN 2020 TLF. This is located 120 million light years from the Earth, and it was observed over 100 days before the supernova event. Just before going supernova, the star erupted with massive flashes of light, And this was all captured in real time by astronomers, shedding new light on what really happens moments before a red giant star goes supernova. We wrap it up with the live sky as we move through the second week of January 2022, and it brings us some interesting sights. The moon moves past its first quarter phase. Now it's in its gibbous phase. It's farthest from Earth, that is, on the 14th at apogee, and gets set for the beautiful full wolf moon on the 17th. For planets, Mercury, the planet, is still visible low in the southwest just after sunset. Venus, George, transitions from the evening sky to the morning sky as we move flatter and into deeper into January. Saturn and Jupiter still are easy to see, that is, in the southwest at sunset. But wrapping it up, three large sunspot groups occupy the sun now. The two-part massive group known as Active Region 2924 and Sunspot Region AR2925, who knows, maybe some flares to come. More information at our website, theskylive.com. Emails, we love them, drskyshow@gmail.com. What do we remind everybody? Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. I'm your navigator on the highway to the heavens. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Stephen. Talk to you next week. The U.S. and Russia have remained at loggerheads after an intense day of high-stakes talks in Geneva over Russia's military buildup on its border with the Ukraine. Though both sides vowed to stay at the table, that's a good thing. Up next, Robert Young Pelton, journalist and world explorer, joins us. That's just one of the topics we'll talk about on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Robert Young Pelton with us. Robert has become an inspiration and role model for a new generation of intellectual adventurers. He's an author, journalist, filmmaker. Several of his books include License to Kill, The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, The Adventurist. He's a filmmaker, photographer, adventurer, explorer, expert, philosopher, and advocate for truth and discovery. He has trained Navy SEALs in survival, participated in special forces training, motivates young people to do meaningful things with their time on this planet. Robert, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing good, George. How are you?
Good to have you. Any more explorations coming up for you?
Well, I spent Christmas at home, so I had a very boring, beautiful.
You deserve it. You've been all over the map, for crying out loud. COVID has not affected you or your loved ones?
No, I've been traveling throughout the entire COVID. I can't express the joy of traveling on an empty aircraft to empty tropical islands, being the only person in a hotel. It's actually been pretty good for me, but stay vaccinated and stay healthy.
It's changed the world. We'll talk a little bit about that. What's your take on what's going on with Russia, the United States, and the Ukraine?
Well, it's a lot of rattling of sabers. You know, despite what Vladimir Putin projects, if you actually look at the size of Russia, it's a very tiny country, and it's dependent on oil sales to Europe. So they, you know, places like Ukraine are strategically important to them. But they couldn't stand up to the U.S. military response. So he's just posturing like all little guys like to do.
Do you think the United States would actually jump in and try to protect the Ukraine?
I think so, because they have to draw a line somewhere. As you know, Russia's been chipping off little bits and pieces of places like Crimea, Donbass, and it is a threat. And Putin is the kind of guy that doesn't back down easily, and knows the weaknesses of Western nations. So we're not about to send B-52s and Dr. Strangelove over there to bomb him. But, you know, if he gets removed from the SWIFT financial system, where some very serious financial penalties are applied to him, that's going to hurt.
Is there any end to this, Robert? I mean, are they going to work things out, in your opinion? And then we'll talk about China and Taiwan in a minute.
No, and this is the reason why I thought it'd be fun to talk about hybrid warfare. But what we're seeing is, we used to call it the Cold War. Remember that? The wall and threatening this and fear of nuclear annihilation.
Hiding under our chairs in school and things like that.
Like the turtle. We're seeing a rebirth of that sort of non-kinetic warfare, where very strange, mysterious things happen to degrade each country. And this is something very serious, because it makes us all combatant. So we can get into that. But Putin is a master of that. You know, he's a master of trickery and creating false flag events and labeling people as terrorists. And as you saw in Kazakhstan, you had a totalitarian government almost overthrown by people who are angry about fuel prices. and suddenly that turned into a terrorist attack and a coup attempt, and Russian and other peacekeepers flew in to snuff it out very quickly. So we're seeing the end of democracy in a lot of places.
Absolutely. Now, when the Soviet Union broke up, why didn't some of these countries that splintered off, these independent countries like Ukraine and Kazakhstan and all those others, why didn't some of them decide to stay with Mother Russia?
Ah, it's funny you mentioned it. I was in the war in Chechnya in 2000.
Wow.
And you remember that after the breakup of the Soviet Union, all these countries had no reason to be involved with the Soviet Union.
Right.
And they declared independence, and they had elections. Like, people forget this, but in the era of 1999, 2000, and before that, Chechnya was actually an independent nation with a democratic government that was monitored by the OSCE. And under Yeltsin, you know, he tried to grab it back because it's that little piece south of Russia, you know, where the Caucasus Mountains are.
Yeah, yeah.
And they lost the war. And there was a very funny situation in which the leader of one of the military units actually negotiated with Yeltsin using hostages, and Yeltsin sort of gave up. And then when Putin came to power, he staged a series of apartment bombings and used that pretext to attack Chechnya. And I interviewed a captured GRU agent in a nuclear bunker who explained how that all went down. That interview was used in a book, and Putin killed the author. He poisoned him with polonium. So the person that paid for that book, Berezovsky, was found hanged, I guess, in his mansion. So it's a real deal. It's a real war. You just don't see it.
How has he, Putin, been able to remain in office so long when I guess he even had the Constitution changed, right?
Yeah, well, not only that, but where did he come from? I mean, he was a former spy.
He KGB guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he came out of nowhere to negotiate sort of an amnesty for Yeltsin, saying that, you know, we're not going to prosecute you, but you need to make me the new leader. And then slowly he worked the Constitution to get rid of the requirement that you only serve so many terms. And now he's basically leader for life. And the country is run by a group of oligarchs, you know, people who are loyal to Putin.
Right.
And run businesses that can't lose money. It's a very interesting model because it's kind of what they were pushing for in the U.S. And again, we get into that. But democracy is very fragile. It's very easy to undermine it using economics and sort of tricky disinformation campaigns, and also playing games with the politics, legal moves and things like that.
And those oligarchs that did not support Putin ended up being in jail, or they're not around anymore.
Or dead, yes. And you got to remember, these people were suddenly told, yes, you're wealthy, but guess what? You've cheated on your taxes and you're going to go to jail. And a number of these people managed to escape to the UK and other places and lead campaigns against Putin. But who does Putin answer to? You know, there's estimates of his wealth that go into the billions of dollars. These people hold these assets for him, and he's like royalty. You know, he is the absolute leader of Russia.
Is he liked in Russia, Robert?
Yes, because you got to remember what Russia was before. You know, Russia was a mess. To buy a bus ticket, you had to bribe somebody. I mean, people wore crappy clothes and barely had food. And then suddenly Putin steps up and puts some national pride in the whole region. So I'd say, yes, he's popular. He's becoming less popular because he won't go away.
What happened to his buddy Medvedev?
I think he was the only guy shorter than Putin, so he was allowed to rule the country for a short period of time. I think he's doing fine. He probably won't be needed anymore because Putin is now leader for life.
But they're friends, aren't they still?
Yes, of course. And there's something very efficient and beautiful about dictatorships. You can get a lot done. Things move very quickly. People don't complain a lot. And everybody makes money who's allowed to make money. So we have to look at these autocracies and oligarchies as being very efficient forms of business.
Robert, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you about this administration here in the United States and its way it's handling Russia, and if you think that's the proper way to handle them. We'll be back in a moment with Robert Young Pelton right here on Coast to Coast. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And definitely, hey, when you get a moment, get a chance to look at some of his work. It is truly fantastic. So we shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Robert Young Pelton. Robert, grade the two administrations for me and their handling of Putin and Russia. First of all, the Trump administration, what would you grade them?
I'd give them a zero because they allowed Putin to do whatever he wanted. There were very few pushbacks. Now, there were sanctions imposed during the Trump administration, but the policy of the Trump administration was to work with autocrats and dictators and, you know, focus on sort of counterterrorism and other issues that they agreed on.
What would you grade the Biden administration?
I give him a five because he's not out the gate yet. You know, he's been faced with two crises so far. Blinken has sort of said tough things and sort of given the correct signs, but we haven't actually pulled the trigger on anything. So, you know, whether it's minor or major things, so far it's just words.
In your professional opinion, is Putin going to go into the Ukraine with the troops that he's got massed along the border?
I don't think so. He's already in the Ukraine, as you know. He took a large chunk of it. They've been fighting constantly. The goal here is to push forward and then grab a little bit and then sort of lean back. What he's trying to do is assert dominance over the region so that it's very painful and expensive for the U.S. and Europe to put troops and sort of lock down the Ukraine. The Ukraine's ready to fight. I mean, they're not afraid of Putin, but the way wars are fought today with drones and, you know, cyber thing, it's just very ugly and messy. So nobody wants a war, but Putin has no problem in doing something and then pulling back.
What were your thoughts of a year ago, the January 6th uprising at the Capitol?
Well, as a guy who's been in many revolutions and rebel camps and whatever, I knew exactly what I was looking at. It was an attempt to overthrow a democratic country. It was very badly executed. You know, obviously, people got cold feet at the last minute, but it was a shot at it. But, you know, I'm also watching what's continuing to this day. And again, we talk about hybrid warfare. There's a thing called lawfare, which is the use of courts and legal intimidation. There's very low-level attacks on school boards. There's synchronized messaging of things to get people upset. It just goes on and on. So that program is still continuing. The idea is to frustrate and to weaken the Democrats in their control of the country and also to sow distrust amongst Americans. Now, you remember, a divided country is a lot easier to damage than a united country. And using false fronts or false flags, you know, makes people like China and Iran and Russia just kind of laugh because we should be united, not fighting.
Why is there so much tension and so much hatred, Robert, today in this country? I mean, I've been through, as you have, the Vietnam War and everything else. This is the most tense I've ever felt this country to be in. Why is that?
Well, it's simple. There used to be a filter. So when somebody wanted to get a message out, it went through the media or came directly from the government. And there was sort of a quality control system in place. With social media, Chinese, Russian, Iranian, Syrian, I mean, the list goes on. These people can reach the American public directly, you know, through Facebook, through Twitter, through just constant sort of iteration of weird and strange things that get people upset. So that filter is gone. You know, they can come directly to your house. And that's why I said, you know, at the front end that you're a combatant in this war. You are being manipulated and targeted by outside forces. And we have to realize that.
China and Taiwan, what do you think is going to happen there?
Taiwan, there will be some point at which China feels confident enough to do something militarily. But China has a lot of patience. You know, if you look at the history of China, they'll wait 20, 30, 40, 50 years and slowly, slowly, slowly take over that place. You know, you see it in the Spratlys. You see it in Africa. You see it in the way they handle the Uyghurs. You see them in their Belt and Road Initiative. they're using every possible tool, whether it be, you know, debt or PR or intimidation, to slowly take control of the areas they want.
Is Taiwan strong enough to fight themselves and protect themselves?
No.
Of course not. Not against China.
Yeah, it's a historical anomaly. Look at Hong Kong. You know, they didn't invade Hong Kong per se, right? They just put a lot of pressure on the border, you know, almost like Ukraine, with a lot of military vehicles. And they slowly degraded anybody who stood in their way until now Hong Kong is a part of China. And we didn't do anything about it.
What's your take on timetable?
On timetable?
Yeah, that's something could happen.
Okay, so what's happened now since sort of 2010, you know, remember Arab Spring and all these democratic movements, is autocrats are very concerned about stamping out democratic movements right at the beginning. I mean, if for example, Kazakhstan, if the people rise up and start complaining about living conditions, within days, that movement is extinguished. Those people, there's 5,000 people in prison, there's over 160 dead. And then we just move on because the media doesn't want to focus on a failed revolution. You know, you saw it in Tiananmen Square. They learned very quickly that you can't let democratic movements succeed. So Arab Spring is basically dead. You know, thanks to the UAE and KSA, they've extinguished every single democratic movement and government that was created during Arab Spring.
What do you think of this Mohammed bin... what's his last
MBZ.
Name in Saudi Arabia?
MBZ is a good player. It's actually going to be his brother, Tanun, that's going to be the crown prince next. So MBZ is kind of moving up into the rulership position when the father dies. They've been very good players, but in 2019, they decided they're going to side with Russia and sort of go after the U.S. Now, they won't say it publicly, but they are working very diligently to degrade the U.S. currency. They're undermining our foreign policy in places like Africa and Asia. And they are going to go toe-to-toe against the U.S., and they're going to back things like, you know, Wagner, the mercenary organization in Russia. It's paid for by the UAE, and most people don't know that. Places like Libya, Sudan, they're paying Russian mercenaries to degrade foreign policy for the U.S.
A friend of mine, Robert, was born in Vietnam and was held by the Viet Cong as a prisoner for a while when he was a young man. And he got out, came to this country, and has made a living for himself, got married to a Vietnamese woman, and has had a great family. His son's a doctor. I mean, he's just a great guy. But he was telling me that years ago, in the beginning, Ho Chi Minh from North Vietnam turned to the United States for help, and we shunned him. Is that true?
Yes, that's very true. So you got to remember that these freedom fighters, you know, whether they be Castro or Ho Chi Minh, were thinking that the U.S. would back any populist uprising. In his case, he was fighting the French, right?
That's
and,
right.
And we kind of looked at that and then realized, oh, wait, you know, he's getting help from the communists, so he's basically our enemy. But for a while there, we supported a number of democratic uprising around the world.
And you mentioned Castro. Batista, who was running Cuba at the time, was a mobster.
Right, and we had very close, if you've seen the movie The Godfather, it's far from the truth. But again, they believe that supporting populist uprisings against dictators would be something that the U.S. would support. And if you remember, Che Guevara even went over to Africa to start some revolutions there and help some freedom fighters. So we're not perfectly clean in the idea that we believe in pure democratic uprisings. But what we're seeing now is President Biden has flatly declared that he's going to support democracies. And what you're seeing is that democracies are being knocked down. And almost like days after he made that speech, Kazakhstan was an example of a group of people rising up to overthrow a totalitarian government, and it was flattened within days.
That's amazing work. And you do amazing work, too, by the way. You still making knives?
Oh, yeah. DPX knives are still available. You know, I make documentaries. I'm working on the failed coup attempt in Libya. and doing documentaries about this because, you know, you remember I was with U.S. Special Forces.
That's right.
When they fought on horseback in Afghanistan, and those guys went off to become contractors, which then sparked my book, License to Kill. And now I'm seeing a lot of these same contractors working for countries like the UAE, but actually backing the extinguishment of democratization and dissidents. You know, there are people working within kill teams to track and harass dissidents who don't believe in sort of dictatorship. So we live in very strange times. I would almost compare it to like the 30s when Hitler was, you know, popular and using all kinds of weird social tricks to get people riled up. So we have to be careful to pay attention to what we see and what we think versus what we know.
I'm not a supporter of us being in Afghanistan when we went in there. I thought we should have leveled Tora Bora with a nuke and wiped out Bin Laden right away. But be that as it may, we went in there. And you think we stayed too long?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you got to remember, we did exactly the right thing. We said we were going to topple the Taliban because they supported terrorism. We went in, we did that within weeks, and then somebody at the State Department said, hey, let's rebuild Afghanistan, even though it had been built the first time. So you're absolutely right. And, you know, I've been there many, many times, and every time I went there was a different reason why we were there. They were, you know, we were fighting a war, we were doing a peacekeeping mission. And as much as I don't like to admit it, you know, the way we got out of there was not pleasant.
No.
But we did need a reboot. We did need to stop and say, why are we spending billions and billions of dollars in this country without results?
What happens, Robert, to the Afghanis who supported us and we leave them there?
Same thing that happened to Vietnamese that we left there. It's ugly. I mean, people supported us.
And everything.
They believed in us, and we just bailed. But this had to happen. You know, we warned them. Trump signed the surrender to the Taliban. It was no secret. Pompeo told everybody we were getting out of there. So the Taliban is still not the official government. So there's some pressure on the Taliban to behave and, you know, modernize, but that's not going to happen. So I'm assuming within, you know, a year or so, people start getting angry and start shooting, and then there'll be another sort of movement to overthrow the Taliban.
What's going on with Iraq right now?
Iraq is a sort of a stable mess. You know, it has oil. People are getting along. There's jostling here and there. But, you know, Iran wants a lot of influence. The U.S. is still kind of there. But Iraq probably will stay semi-stable. There's no reason for us to get involved in any heavy way yet.
Now, of course, they never found any weapons of mass destruction there.
Because they spent 10 years making sure there weren't any. So it was kind of an interesting situation.
So what got Saddam Hussein really in trouble with us? What did he do? Was it going into Kuwait that was his end?
No, we wanted to bookend Iran. The goal was always Iran. You know, Cheney and the neocons, their goal was to essentially change the Middle East, get rid of all these bad guys, put in democratic governments. It just didn't work, right? So we were in Afghanistan, and we stayed there because we were also going to go into Iran. We were going to start a war with Iran, and thank God it never happened. But there was a goal to basically reshape every autocratic government in the Middle East, and now with Assad of Syria basically winning, we kind of went the other way by saying, okay, better to have a dictator that does all the dirty work for us than to try to create democracies.
Do you think displacing Gaddafi in Libya was a smart thing to do?
Well, we didn't do that. The people did that. You know, he was past his time. He was out of touch with the people. We helped with, you know, intelligence and airstrikes, et cetera, but other people have gone in there and started stirring things up. And we talked about the UAE and this American guy, Khalifa Haftar, who was a retiree from Virginia, suddenly becomes a warlord. They spent something like $30 billion of Gaddafi's stolen money to keep that war going. And they still are sort of trying to keep it unstable because this is the new thing, is to keep countries messed up. In other words, don't fix anything. Don't build anything. Just keep it messed up.
Chaos.
To deal with.
Yep, chaos. Listen to the scenario I'm hearing from a couple guests. Tell me what you think. That President Joe Biden will step down for whatever reason. Kamala Harris becomes president, names Hillary as vice president, and Hillary runs in 2024 again. What do you think of that?
Good Lord, man. Wait, who are these people? No, I think Hillary's done. I think Hillary was not liked by a lot of people.
So you don't think that scenario could unfold, huh?
No. I mean, Joe Biden is old. I mean, you know, you can see it in how he walks and talks.
Yeah, that's what they're concerned about.
Yeah, but he's also been around for a long time, so he knows his way around. Now, will he get his agenda done? No. But do the Republicans have a better idea? No. You know, it's like throwing rocks at the buildings, thinking that that's how you run a country. I think there's better solutions to that. And like I said, the key is with the people of America. You know, we have to stop bickering amongst ourselves, and we have to start thinking about, okay, why are we so divided? Who made us divided? We shouldn't be calling names that, you know, right versus left. We should be looking outside the country saying, who wants us like this?
Absolutely.
And there are plenty of countries like China, Russia, UAE, whatever, that want us to bicker.
Robert, we're at the top of the hour. Hold on. We're going to come back and take an hour of phone calls with you. Robert Young Pelton, our special guest, a couple of his books, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, The Adventurous, and his website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We will come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM and take your phone calls. Don't touch your dial. We will be right back on Coast to Coast AM.